Usually I just base the talk on a few things which happened, usually today, and had a number of people come up, talk about all sorts of things. It's lovely to be able to relate the talk to daily life and to use these great Buddhist principles to understand that these teachings of the Buddha, which are revealed in meditation, they do apply and they do work. I've been saying to people recently that when you look at the relics of the Buddha, there's all sorts of relic exhibitions around the world, but the real relic of the Buddha is a teaching, is the Dharma. That's the relic of the Buddha. That's what the Buddha bequeathed to us. The teachings. And what are those teachings? The teachings which, when we put into practice, give us a bigger understanding of the nature of life, and we know it's the right understanding because it brings us peace and freedom. That's a sign of truth. That brings us peace and freedom. So the real relic of the Buddha is not some pieces of bone. It's the teachings which he bequeathed to us. And somebody recently asked me, now what is the Buddhist holy book? Because the Christians have got the Bible. Muslims have got the Torah. The Muslims have got the Quran. What is the Buddhist holy book? You know what the Buddhist holy book is? Meditation. In other words, it's a practice, not a sort of a book. And if it's real practice, in other words, seeing inside oneself, seeing inside of one's life, using that and reading that well and understanding, so the story of your experience, this is where we get the teachings of the Buddha from. So the books, we always call them the menus. They're always supposed to be pointing to the food. If you just eat menus and never eat food, you're going to get very hungry. And you think, wow, menus don't work. What a terrible restaurant that is. All I do is eat paper all day. And some people go to churches, mosques, temples, and that's all they do. They just eat paper. And they go away and say, this doesn't work. What a waste of time. And it's quite true, because here we want to serve the food. And the food this evening is, on the menu tonight, is learning how to let go. But especially learning, focusing on letting go of people and not being attached to people. And understanding what that attachment is. And understanding what letting go is. And why we should let go. And how we should let go. It's because seeing, sort of as part of my life, is that you're always invited to people when they're dying, seeing them in hospital, seeing them really sick. Sometimes you don't see people for years until they get sick and then they call you up, can you come and see me, Ajahn Brahm? But I don't mind. It's a nice time to see people, to wave them off as they go on their long journey. Not only that, you see sort of the relations as well, trying to cope with the experience of death. And sometimes I look at people, the way they react to the death, and think, you can do better than that. When people, you've been married for such a long time, and your partner is dying, and maybe just not an old person, a young person dies as well. But can't we cope with this much better? Because the promise of understanding is actually lessening suffering, giving more peace, more wisdom, and seeing the meaning behind these events of our life. Someone was telling me earlier about a young child who died, committed suicide, and said, for sometimes that's very hard for the parents and the family to bear, but it does not need to be hard. Because I know that sometimes when somebody dies and they're not at their full lifespan yet, one of the first responses people have is always guilt. They always think, oh, I could have done more. Maybe if I'd have done this, maybe if I'd have taken my partner to the hospital earlier, or maybe got her diagnosed, or changed their lifestyle, or been kinder to them. And so much guilt comes with the death. Mostly because, you know, our cultures these days are very much into finding fault and blaming. And if we can't find someone else to blame, we blame ourselves. But one of the wonderful teachings, which should be obvious to people of all faiths and religions, any rational person who contemplates, is that death is part of our life. And it should not be regarded as a negative part of our life. For those people who are left behind when youngsters die, and sometimes that's one of the hardest things for our society to accept, the death of a young child. I wrote the story in a book, which I will abridge, It's a simile of that, the leaves falling from a tree. When a storm blows through any forest, and I live in a forest down at Serpentine in our monastery. If you want to sort of see this for yourself, you just come to our monastery after a storm, after a heavy wind. You won't just see trees come down, you see many leaves being blown off the tree. When the wind blows, it doesn't just take the old brown curly leaves. It takes many young leaves as well, many young green shoots. They too get torn off the tree of life and lay dead on the floor. Sometimes you look at them, little young green shoots on the floor. You look up at the tree and you see that same old brown curly old leaf which has been survived so many storms and still hangs on there, still is in life. I don't know how many old people I know, 80, 85, 90, 96, they're still clinging on. It's not their fault. Don't need to feel guilty. Anyone here over 80, you don't need to get into a guilt trip by being 80. This is just life. And the point is that when we understand that nothing has gone wrong, it's not the wind's fault that young green leaves lie on the ground. It's nature. Sometimes making comparisons to nature actually helps us to understand, you know, the reality of our human life. Because we're not apart from nature. We're embedded in nature. We're part of nature. And just like green leaves fall from a tree, so do young people. Nothing has gone wrong. It's part of life, which we have to accept nature. I once gave a very powerful definition of suffering. Very quick and easy, because those quick and easy ones are sometimes the deepest. Suffering, pain of the heart, is expecting from life what it can never give you. Expecting what it can never provide you. And what we expect is that everyone will be provided with the full span of life, especially our family and children. And of course, you can never expect that. Sometimes it is your friend, your relation, your child, who dies when they're only 11 years of age. You have to embrace that. That is part of our life. It is not that someone has made a big mistake. When we can accept and at least get rid of the anger and blame, we've gone to the first stage of understanding this life. No one's at fault. This is the meaning of our life. This is the nature of life. This is its truth. And if we try and fight the truth of nature, we only make more pain and suffering for ourselves and others. When we accept and embrace the law of nature, it makes it much easier. And anyway, as Buddhists, or many of you are Buddhists, and even not non-Buddhists, many people believe in reincarnation, even non-Buddhists. So why can't we believe that it's only a temporary parting? Young child dies, they're going to come back again and have another chance. Death is not the end of the world. People think it is sometimes. In our materialistic society, I don't know, we've got it all wrong. We think, someone's dying. Yeah, we die. We sort of graduate from school, we graduate from university, we get married, we go to different countries, we move around. Death is just a moving from one plane of existence to another plane of existence. It's not a finality. So understanding reincarnation, understanding it deep inside and seeing the bigger picture, young person dies, they'll have another chance. Because that's really what we want. When something like that happens, can we not give them another chance to make it fair? Because one of the problems we have, we think, it's not just, it's not fair that young people, when they haven't had a chance of life, they die so soon. We sometimes think it's not fair that some people, they work less hard than you do, and they become rich. Why is it that it's so unfair that some people win the lottery, and you don't, and you've been playing every week, and you've been such a good person, and offering food to the monks, and doing all this sort of stuff, and you still haven't won? It's really unfair. But you notice, anyone who does win the lottery, they don't think, I've won the lottery, that's unfair. It is unfair if you win the lottery. It's unfair as other people didn't and you did. Do you ever feel guilty about that? I don't think anyone who wins the lottery ever feels guilty. Because our idea of fairness and justice is skewed. It is fair that leaves fall from a tree. Sometimes that's your leaf. Sometimes that's your relation. So don't think that something's gone wrong or it's unjust. It's part of life. Understanding reincarnation, realize that, well, we'll have another chance next time. One of the most amazing things, though, is it just getting rid of the negative part which allows us to let go. Sometimes we're stopped from the negative part of letting go, the pain, the misery. That stops us moving on. We actually really attached and owned the misery. Still remember going to a grief and loss conference many years ago in Scarborough Beach Hotel and seeing so many of actually the speakers. These were people who were famous for their grief. Celebrity grievers. People like the parents of Kiera Glennon. I might get into trouble for saying that, but sometimes people, they go on stage, and by grieving, they have an identity, and they can't let that one go. They can't move on. It's as if that they are attached to the pain of the past. So I remember, I forget who it was, someone complained to me, they're telling us we should let go. Yeah, sure, why not? I don't want to. It's amazing just how many people like their sadness. But if we are wise, we can have an opportunity to move forward, to move on, to let that one go. So letting go of the negative part of it, we can see the positive part of it. And people get amazed sometimes. How can you see something positive, say, in the death of a young child? Or the death of your mother, your father? I told somebody earlier that in the story of the Buddha, which many of you would have read, or if you're a traditional Buddhist, you'd learn at the temple many times. The Buddha was a prince before, and he saw four sights, which were wake-up call to him. The old man, the sick man, the dead man, and the holy man. Especially the dead man. It really woke him up to the meaning of life. There was something powerful and important there, of actually seeing death and feeling it and knowing it and allowing that death to go right inside of him. Unfortunately, in our present day, sometimes we don't even talk about death. I was really amazed when I came to Australia 25 years ago. No one died here. They just passed to the other side. They just they went to meet Auntie Fanny on the other side. They were reunited again, but no one actually said they died. They carked it. They snuffed it, or whatever you call it. Why can't we actually just be honest about it? The people die. They don't pass to the other side. They don't, they're just only sleeping. Then they look so peaceful. Because I'm a leader of a religion, that sometimes you get invited by the funeral directors to see where that smile comes from. That's all the embalmer's job. To make sure when a person dies that they are injected with chemicals, made sure they put a smile on the face before they present it to their loved ones. Sometimes you see like a fresh corpse, a real dead person. They never look like what you see in the box. They look completely different, very grey and pallid, no colour in their body at all. However, we make up this illusion to make relations feel good. Sometimes I think that's counterproductive. It's much better to get closer to death. It's one of my wonderful experiences, and I say it's a wonderful experience. People might think I'm strange, that when my father died, I was just woken up in the middle of the night. He died at home. My mother couldn't wake him, so I tried shaking him. Tried to shake him out of his death and make him alive again. It's only a 16-year-old boy. But I always remember that, shaking my father. You can see his face. Recognizably, that was the father I loved. Shaking him, feeling him, but his body was cold and stiff. His mouth wouldn't open. His eyes were tight. Nothing I could do was to bring back that person I recognized. He was dead. But that was an important experience for me, because I could face up and come close and feel and touch and know deeply the death. You know, it wasn't that frightening. When we actually accept these things, we learn from them and grow from them. And of course, the meaning of death, what we get out of this, the teaching we get out of this, why the Buddha called it a messenger of truth, was it because it made me more appreciative of this life. When you know that just as that's your father, that's someone you know, you've lived with, you've talked with, you've argued with, you've gone, spend your life with. When you know that they're going to die, it's very obvious that that's going to happen to you. And of course, we all know we're going to die, but we don't. We think we do. Which is why we live some quite heedless lives sometimes. But when actually you have somebody, say an 11-year-old die, and I think you're all over 11 in this room here, it means that you too can die at any time, any moment, even before you go home, you can die. Understanding that makes life more precious, makes this moment more precious. By understanding the nature of death, you actually have a greater understanding of the meaning of life. What is life? Why is life? When you've only got a certain amount of time left, what are you going to do? How are you going to use it? A person who knows they're going to die, like many people when they have cancer, it's amazing just how they change their agendas. Cancer is a wonderful sickness in that it really gets us very close to the meaning of death, and we've got time. We've got time to understand it and to make the necessary changes to our life, to our attitude, to accommodate a death which is going to be very likely. Some people get through their cancer, they don't die. But my goodness, they learn so much. And even if they do die, wow, they still learnt a lot, which they will take with them into death. And of course, what do you learn by these things? By seeing a young person die, a middle-aged person die, an old person die, it means that you can die at any time. There is no rule for the time you will die. Never think that you are 30, so you've got another 40 years left. Never think you're 50, so, you know, 80 I'm going to die. You can die at any moment. Because of that, that means that every moment becomes much more vital. And it's not just making money, not just paying the rent or getting the mortgage or getting on in life. What becomes more important, you know, is what we call basically spiritual values. Your kindness, your generosity, your virtue, your wisdom, your understanding, what you're coming here for is what you will take with you when you die. What is the most meaningful thing of your life? Sometimes, you know, I work really hard. I just come back from 10 days over in Singapore, just a couple of days over there, but mostly in Malaysia, just working really hard, teaching meditation, teaching retreats, counseling people, talking to people whose children have died or someone else has got cancer or getting divorced or trying to reconcile couples who are still together but want to get divorced. It's a lot of hard work, which I do as a monk, but you know, sometimes you get so physically exhausted, but so mentally, so inspired, because you're doing so much to help other beings. I know what the meaning of life is. The meaning of life is, and most of it, to serve, to give, to help, to solve problems with yourself and other people, to bring this beautiful peace and harmony and kindness into this world, to create those bridges between people. Even going to prison in Singapore for just one afternoon and getting these people who just got such a low self-esteem. In a Chinese community, especially in a place like Singapore, being put in jail for 12, 13 years. Imagine what that feels like. So my job is in there, is actually to love those prisoners, not to criticize them, to show them value, so they can value themselves, to show they're not criminals, they're just people who've done crimes, that's all. They're people, they're beings, they're humans. They're not very, hardly any different from me. It's just the only difference was they got caught. We didn't. How many of you have done things which if you were caught, you might end up in jail? So understanding that this is the meaning of life is giving people a bigger sense of wisdom so they can get peace, freedom. They really can have love and happiness. And just talking to people who've had the suffering of losing a loved one. It's a wonderful privilege to be able to take a person like that and lead them out of that hole into a sense of peace and freedom and moving on. And when they've learned how to deal with the death, and they've gone forward, what a wonderful lesson that is. That's why when anyone dies, young, old, whatever, the meaning of their death is teaching you the importance of life and what's really valuable in your life. So when somebody dies young, never think of it as a waste. Never think, why did this happen? It happened to teach you, to give you an idea of the importance of life, and to change the attitudes which one has. As I've counseled many mothers who've given stillbirth to a baby, come so close to having a child in their life to love, to care for, to nurture and cherish. So close, but at the birth, the baby is dead. Would you rather that little being had never come into your womb? When I ask a question like that, the mother says, of course not. It's wonderful just how mothers, when they have that little being in the womb, they're visited by somebody, even though they can't see them, they can't talk to them, they can touch them and feel them. 9 months. Thank you so much for that visit. What a wonderful time we have. We are grateful you've come so far. We'd have loved you to come further, but thank you for so much time just in my womb. You see, what we're doing there is we're valuing what we have. We're being grateful for the little things we have. Rather than wanting more and expecting more and demanding more and getting angry and upset when we don't get more. 6 months, 9 months, thank you so much. You had a being there which loved you and you loved it. Longer than that, 11 years. Wow, thank you for those 11 years. For anyone who had a child who died, would you rather that child had never ever come into your life at all? Seeing even parents with autistic children or Down syndrome children who take so much attention, almost constant care. I asked them, do you understand the meaning of why you've given birth to such a child? Some of them understand. That child is teaching us what it means to love. Not to love someone because you can see them grow and go to school and be proud of them, but to be able to love someone who will never go to school, who may never even be able to speak back to you, never be able to even say the word mummy or daddy, but still can love you back. It's amazing to be able to see this in action and see people take these amazing lessons in life and understand them. You know, one of the places where I learnt love, I don't mind saying this, but that was when I was a student at Cambridge. This was done out of pride, first of all, out of arrogance. I was a Buddhist at university, and I was proud of being a Buddhist. I was the only Buddhist in my college that I knew of, so all my friends are either Christians or they're mostly atheists. They believed in the great bottle of bitter beer. That's a religion they... They used to go to church every evening, and their church was a pub. That was their religion. But they were my friends, and we enjoyed each other's company. But one of my best friends was quite a devout Christian. And he told me that he was going to do some social work by going to the local hospital where they had a ward for Down syndrome children. And I thought to myself, I can't be outdone by the Christians. So I said, I want to go too as a Buddhist. So I got in with these three other quite devout Christians. And I met one of the other ones later on, became a sort of an Anglican priest. So there we went, four of us, three Christians and one Buddhist, down to actually to do social service, to do something good, to be a goody-goody Buddhist. To supposedly do some good karma. I went to this ward just to do a little bit of occupational therapy for these kids who had Down syndrome. and I thought I was going there to do some service. But of course, anyone who's done any type of social work realizes you are the one who receives the service. For 2 years I went to that hospital every afternoon when I was up in college. I got to know those Down syndrome kids so well. What they taught me was what these days we call emotional intelligence, a sensitivity where you can't speak to somebody with words, but gee, you can really understand what they're thinking or where they're coming from. These Down syndrome kids, if I was in a bad mood, you can see them and they would come and hug you and say, never mind, in their own way. And they could laugh and feel at ease when you were at ease. Their emotional intelligence was much, much stronger than all my so-called friends. I learned so much about love from those little kids. I wouldn't call them kids, some were in their 20s, 30s. They wouldn't live very long. I'm not quite sure why they didn't have a big life expectancy. But your job was to learn how to be loved and to give that love back unconditionally. Never expected them to get better, never expected them to sort of perform like I did, but to love them for who they are, even though they were always going to be in that state. It's amazing just what a quality of life they would have if you were just around them, accepting them, embracing them for who they are, and allowing them to be. That's what love is. To giving, enjoying each other's company, with no strings attached, allowing the other person to be. And that's what the meaning of a death is. You allow a person to die at 11, at 5, at 15. Real love, and this is what the meaning of knowing a death when someone's young, is learning how to embrace them, even their short life, for who they are. Thank you so much for those 11 years, those 15 years, those 20 years. Thank you so much. That meant so much to me. When we expect, ask, demand more, because we're saying it's not right that people die so young. It's not right that kids are born autistic. It's not right that people have Down syndrome. There must be something wrong. The doctors didn't look after them. I know that the life is not, there's not such a word as something's gone wrong. No more you can you say that because the green leaves fall that something's gone wrong. When you understand life deeply, you have to accept it, you have to embrace it. When you do accept and embrace it, the whole thing changes. It's Down syndrome children. They're not like mistakes, they're valued. You truly do love them. And you enjoy their company. That's why for 2 years, after the first few weeks, I never thought I was doing any social service. I actually enjoyed as much as going to see your girlfriend. You know, you look forward to it. It's crazy, but I really did because I enjoyed those kids' company. And I learned so much from them. The same way you can enjoy a person's death when you embrace it. You learn so much from that. Sometimes when a person dies young, we think, why? What's the purpose? What's the meaning? If it's meaningless, that really confuses people and makes them angry. Why did this happen? They keep saying, why does a person do this? And sometimes people commit suicide. Why? That's not really loving, understanding. If someone commits suicide, I will never know why. Whatever it was in their mind, in their heart at the time. Who knows, they may have just been playing around, making mistakes, not truly understanding what they were doing or why they were doing it. My job will never be to judge, because I know I'm incapable of judging a person. How do I know what they went through and why they did that and why they decided that? Who knows? What I can do is love and respect them. If that's the way they end their life, I accept their decision. Value them. You never think it's a waste because they'll come back again. Have another go. Maybe don't do that next time. There's another ways of dealing with problems. But still we can love and accept people. We can embrace and respect and free the other person and ourselves. When we can actually do that, we have this bigger mind. I don't know how many times any one of you has got so depressed, or really not so much depressed, but confused. You think that, you know, if you had a gun or a knife or a piece of rope, that you would have killed yourself. There's a funny story. I'm not sure this fellow won't mind me saying this. He was a former caretaker of this center. And he went off to live in the bush to retire. Found a nice little place, but being by himself, he got quite lonely. And we always have our bad days. One day he was so depressed that he decided this was it. No point to life. You're going to kill himself. So he went into his shed and he tied the rope to the rafters, tied a noose, put the chair there, already the right height, tested it all. The only thing left was to go and write the suicide note. And he was writing the suicide note. He had the radio on at the time. And as he was writing the suicide note, maybe 2 or 3 minutes from hanging himself, who came on the radio but Ajahn Brahm being interviewed? And he said, "Oh no, Ajahn Brahm won't let me commit suicide." So he tore up the note, untied the rope, and he wrote a letter to me and telling me about this. He was laughing his head off, you know, when he was telling me this. Ajahn Brahm, I just happened to come on the radio and he happened to be, have that channel on. He forgot to turn the radio off. And there he was, so I stopped him committing suicide. Coincidence. But you know, we all have those moments. I'm sure every one of you have had a moment like that. Maybe not that close, but you can understand how if you got just a little bit more, if you didn't have the friends, you didn't have the radio on at the time or whatever, you could have also gone over there. Now can you understand how other people do that? Love is understanding. Not criticizing, not judging. Even though you may not be able to understand it fully, you can go halfway to understanding it. And that's enough to give this beautiful sense of forgiveness and letting go, moving on, embracing. Because as that title of that book, which I keep on quoting, Opening the Door of Your Heart, now being translated into Hebrew, which the Dutch edition also is coming out. There's many editions of that book. Story from my father, when he said, "Son, the door of my heart is open to you." The most important part of that, no matter what you ever do in your life. What he meant is, "Son, I'd always love you, even if you did commit suicide. No matter what you did. Even though I didn't do that, wouldn't do that, I became a monk instead. Nevertheless, I knew from that wonderful saying of my father, it was an unconditional love, an unconditional embracing, forgiveness, acceptance. Now that is really spiritual and religious. And that's what the death of an 11-year-old will teach us. How to love them. How to love them so much, you're at peace with their suicide. You let them go, rather than holding on. Because we're talking about attachment in Buddhism, and somebody was asking me earlier, what actually is attachment? When you love somebody, isn't that being attached to them? But we have this wonderful word, even in English, when we have a relationship with no strings attached. So you can love someone, but with no strings attached. And I like that metaphor of a string between two people. A string between a mother and their son. Between sort of a husband and their wife. Between, you know, disciple and their monk or whatever. When there's any strings there, that's called the attachment. And you know there's a string there where you can feel the push and the pull between a person. When you don't do the thing I want, you know, when you do something which, you know, I don't approve of. Now that will be like love with strings attached. That's the attachment love. And I will love you, but please, please, please don't kill yourself. Because I want you to be here. For who? For you or for me. So much of grief is not being sad for the person who's died, but being sad for yourself. You feel sad because something you wanted is no longer there. What you thought you were attached to has now been broken. Your expectations have been frustrated. You wanted that person
to grow up, to see them grow up. You can't always have that. What you can have is loving them right now for who they are. When it's their time, letting them go, giving them freedom to go in peace. Some of the most beautiful scenes which I've had in life. And one of the things which I encourage people to do when you're close to a person before they die, in the last few days, please give them permission to die. First time I've seen her, I can't see her this evening. One of the regular members who comes here, I was counseling them when she was with her husband. Very young people, maybe in her 30s, late 30s. He got cancer. No, inoperable. He was dying. So I went around to see them for the last few days. And I still remember, this is what they taught me, what this wonderful fellow taught me about love. When I saw him and her, there was a tension, a tightness there. Couldn't put my finger on it, but there was a tension in the room, in the bedroom, while he was about maybe a day or two from dying. But fortunately, as a monk, because you have mindfulness, because you have stillness, you can very easily can make your mind so peaceful. You don't try and think out the problem. You can feel the problem. You can intuit the problem. And I could intuit it. I knew what was going on. So I remember turning to the wife. I don't want to mention their names because they're probably well known here. I told her, have you given permission for your husband to die yet? Have you given him permission to go? And I'd intuited right because she didn't even answer me. She just jumped on the bed, hugged her husband, who was just so weak in the last stages of cancer, and said, darling, I love you so much. I give you permission to die. You can go with my love. It's one of the most beautiful memories I have. When a wife who loved her husband so much, still young, loved him enough to give him permission to go. And he died the next day or 2 days later. But he died at peace. She gave him the permission to go in peace. What a wonderful gift of love that was. And I encourage you, because you'll have that experience sooner or later, your father, your mother, even brothers and sisters, your husband, your wife, or even your child. If a child gets to that point of no return, please tell them you love them so much that you free them. The door of my heart's open to you, daughter. I give you permission to go. Go in peace. I let you go. That's the love which isn't attached. That's a love which frees. That's a letting go. The sort of thing which the Buddha kept on talking about. The understand and know the difference between attachment, where you have a string and it keeps pulling at you and you keep pulling at those. That's not freedom. And a beautiful, wonderful, inspiring, uplifting, freeing love. So, if that ever happens to you, and there's so many suicides these days, if you have a loved one who commits suicide, if you never give them permission to go beforehand, give them permission afterwards. Sometimes we do that in Buddhism. Sometimes if somebody steals anything from the donation box, you say afterwards, oh, we give that to you, so they don't create any bad karma. We give it to them afterwards. It's a wonderful little idea. Somebody takes something, you say, okay, never mind, it's yours. So that you lost it anyway, you might as well let it go. It's the same way when somebody has already died, or someone, say, committed suicide. You give them permission after the event. So there's no blame. There's no criticism. There's no, why did you do that for? You allow them to do it afterwards. This is a wonderful freedom. It's saying, I love you. The door of my heart's open to you. No matter what you've done. When you can do things like that, You know that this is a beautiful, freeing, wonderful love which stops and helps the problems. We have to let each other go sooner. You don't let a person go when they're young. You have to let them go afterwards. Sometimes you're the one who's dying. You have to let them go. I'm not going to see you again, darling. I'm going before you. You'll come later. You know that happens. Or you get children when they grow up and they sort of want to leave home. It's amazing just how many kids stay at home year after year after year. And sometimes, I know some parents just will not let their kids go. Remember, this is one other lovely teaching. Those children aren't yours. Sometimes we think, that's my daughter, that's my son. They come into your life. Where do they come from? The Buddhists, I know they come from previous existence, previous lives. Be careful when you get pregnant. You don't know what's coming into your womb. I don't know what sort of Osama bin Laden's mother thought. I'm sure she thought it was a wonderful little baby, or Adolf Hitler's mum, Mrs. Hitler. I'm sure she's a very nice lady. But, so you never know what's coming in. Because you don't choose them. I know they've got baby shops. I remember this. No, I haven't told a joke yet. This is the old joke. I'm not sure. The last time I taught this one. About, you know, when the Berlin Wall went down and Eastern Germany and Western Germany were united. And then one of the people from Eastern Germany, they could actually go to the West. And he went into a supermarket. He'd never been into a supermarket with all his amazing products, because in the communist bloc East, behind the Iron Curtain, they hardly had any luxury goods at all. And he went down to the supermarket, he saw, mashed potato powder. You know, you've seen that? You just add water and you get mashed potatoes. This is amazing. Mashed potato powder. You don't even have to mash the potatoes yourself. Just add water and there you got. And he's got cake powder. Again, just add water and you get cake. And then he saw baby powder. Wow, these people in the West are so amazing. Just add water, you get a baby. But unfortunately, you know, you don't go to a supermarket to choose your baby. There you go, you get pregnant. And it's nothing to do with your DNA or your combined genetics. It'd be wonderful if you could actually know what sort of baby you got by, you know, your genetics. But it doesn't work. The best kids have monsters for children. And monstrous parents have these amazing saints for children. So, is that child really yours? No, it comes from somewhere else. You give it a body. You care for it. You love it. You nurture it. The best you possibly can. But when you know it's not yours, you know you have to let it go. One day it's going to leave you. One day it's going to go and marry this guy or marry this girl. Whether you like it or not, that's what they're going to do. They're going to go off maybe to another part of the world for their jobs. You have to let them go. Because your job is done. I always say parents should remember the birds. Birds, they sit on those hard eggs. For those of you who got sore bottom, who've been sitting for an hour and a half, that's nothing compared to these birds. At least you want a sort of a soft cushion. Imagine what an egg is like, poking into your bum for hours on time. Wow, that's tough. And they sit for days on that. And then when birds hatch, they go around all over the place getting worms, getting whatever they can. And those baby birds, they're just like buckets. They're vacuum cleaners. They'll just suck everything that mother and father bird. It's not just the mother, as well, the father gets things for them as well. And then they have to teach them how to fly. You know, it's living in the bush, sometimes you see. So the mother bird's teaching them to fly. When I did my 6-month retreat, you saw a couple of eagles living close by. And you used to watch in the afternoon them teaching their young one to fly. It's a wonderful thing to see nature like that. See like an eagle, two eagles, teaching their youngster to fly. A mother on one behind, one in front, and the little one in between. But of course, once they can fly, that's it. Mum and Dad, go away. Junior, you look after yourself from here on in. No more free worms. You can find your own. I think, wouldn't it be wonderful if parents were like that? Now, once your kids can drive the car, okay, off you go, you buy your own car. You can go find your own home.
Maybe you can't do that quite, but at least we can let them go. This is what we have to do. This is what love truly is. To love a person, to care for them, to give them our whole heart, but not to put them in a prison because of our love. And that's actually how we love each other in a relationship as well. Husband and wife. I don't know how many dysfunctional marriages there are because one partner wants to control the other. Out of fear, they love the person, they think they love them, but with no wisdom. They're afraid what their partner might do, so they're always sending the private investigator after them. Or whatever, because, you know, you're coming home late, darling, why? I've got to work, I've got to go to the Buddhist Society to do extra things for Ajahn Brahm. Yeah! No, people do that, they're good people, but a lot of times, because we don't trust the other person, that's why the marriage breaks down. What we fear the most, we make happen. Because of our dysfunctional relationship. Trust has to be part of love. That's when my father said to me, the door of your heart's always open to me, no matter what you ever do. It wasn't just an expression of love, it's an expression of trust. Say, off you go into your life. I don't care, well, I do care what happens to you. I want you to be happy, but I give you that freedom to find out, see what happens. Even if you die, I will love you. What a wonderful freeing feeling that was. And it wasn't the case that when you give a person that freedom, that trust, my experience of life, and not my own life, other people's lives, because people come and talk to me and tell me their problems, I follow them. I've been in this city now for 25 years, over 25 years, and so I've known some of these kids grow up and seen them be so successful. And I can see that these teachings of Dharma actually work. You give your kids some trust, they usually live up to it. If you don't trust them, if you keep too much of a guard on them, that's when they usually go wrong. They rebel. They fight. And they've got no one to go back to afterwards because their relationship with their parents has been busted. Always err on the side of extra trust. Obviously, if you've got a kid, a young kid, put some boundaries on them, and the dangerous ones, the ones which will really hurt them for a long time, things like drugs, or, you know, especially for a girl, you know, premarital sex, at least teach your kids about contraception. I know that sometimes I mention that word here, and I got letters back saying, you shouldn't say that, you're a monk. Look, I care about you, and I care about your kids, and there's some young kids here, you've got to mention those words so everybody knows them. So you don't get into problems and difficulties later on in your life, or even in this part of your life. You've got to sort of be realistic and practical about these things. So if we do these sorts of things, we can actually protect our children by being some boundaries about them, educating them, caring for them. You're equipping them for life. And also for making mistakes, which is where we all learn. I told somebody that, you know, I wasn't sort of a perfect child when I grew up. You know, that one of the stupid things which I did, which I told someone about, was making a bomb. I'd go to jail if I did that these days. Probably not any old jail, probably get sent to Guantanamo Bay. I was only 11 years of age with one of my best friends who was a chemistry whiz, and his elder brother had all his chemicals because he was a bit of a chemist in his house. So he knew how to make something go bang. So, you know, he mixed the chemicals. I provided the tin can. We went to the local park, and it worked. It went bang! And I thought it was the most exciting thing until the park keeper caught us. We got into big trouble. It was a stupid thing. I could have killed myself. But for a young kid, especially a boy, sometimes that's what we do. And so sometimes you have to give people a little bit of freedom and trust. Put boundaries on them so they don't kill themselves or blow themselves up really. Or get into drugs, or get into some really bad stuff, but give it a lot of freedom. And they usually work out okay. And you give them trust, they become wonderful kids. Which is what we're doing, we're trusting a person to die. This is what we mean by letting go of people. We trust our wife, we trust our husband. To let them go out at night, to stay late at the office, we trust them. And even if they misuse our trust, and they do have an affair outside of marriage.
you haven't done anything wrong. They'd have done that even if you'd have just tried to, they'd probably done it earlier if you'd have tried to control them. This is why the main reason why we let go is because the opposite is being too much of a control freak. If you can let go of people, allow people to die when it's their time, their karma, whatever. And I should mention the law of karma because people got some weird ideas about karma in Buddhism. They say, someone's committed suicide, that's terrible karma, they'll go to hell. Oh, come on. Sort of, now, why, it's like a young person made that decision. It's usually out of so much confusion. And for karma to be a very bad karma, it has to be done mindfully, deliberately, with full awareness that this is wrong, you know it's wrong, just go and do it. That's bad karma. If you're in a very confused state, you're not really quite sure what's up and down, left and right, then because of that confusion, the karmic force is very, very small. And this is sometimes why I say, like, suicide is usually not great bad karma. Because the quality of the intention, the confusion, it's a stupid thing to do, it's not a good thing to do, it's the wrong thing to do. But then the quality of your mind, if you're in such a state, is usually very, very confused. It's not clear. Because it's not clear, the karmic force is not very pronounced. But it's not just that. Why did people keep on focusing on one event? That's bad karma. You did that. I say when I went into Changi Jail last week, in Singapore, look, you are not criminals, told those prisoners in the jail. You are people who've done crimes. There's more to you than that event for which you're in this prison right now. In the same way a person commits suicide, they're not a suicidal person. That's more than that. That's just one event which probably took 1 or 2 minutes of their life, of their time. What else did they do? As far as the karmic force of a person's life, it's not just one event, you have to see the whole life. Be fair, what else did they do in their life? And probably there's so much kindness, so much goodness, so much wonderful things. But why do you judge a person on one fault, 2 faults, 3 faults, 10 faults? And completely ignore the thousands, the millions of kind, loving, generous, beautiful actions which a person does. When we see the big picture, the whole picture, and that's what truth is supposed to do, open us to see that sometimes we're so narrow-minded. We just see one part of the story, and the job of a monk or the Dhamma is to expand so you see the big picture. They were a good person, kind, generous. 1 or 2 mistakes which caused their death. Doesn't mean that's bad karma, but all the other wonderful, good, tremendous, loving things they've done in their life are somehow don't count. Karma is a balance. It's a full sum up of what you've been doing in your whole life, not just one event. So if you know someone has committed suicide, don't think, wow, bad karma, they're going to go to hell. Come off it. Number one, that event was a very confused event. It doesn't have much karmic force. And don't think of all the other good stuff they've done. That's why sometimes people commit suicide, they go to heaven. You say, why? Now you know the answer. So karma is not some fatalistic, and don't sort of use karma as an excuse for blame or for negativity or for hate or even for hating yourself called grief or guilt. We don't need to do that in life. Now imagine if people had this sort of understanding. So when a person did die, we can let them go. We can go to their funeral. We can sing their praises, and we can learn and understand that their death had a meaning for us, reminding ourselves of our impermanent time in this planet, so that we can live better, that we can work better, speak better, be kinder, and be more generous. It gives us a purpose of life when we see that it's not going to last forever. Purpose is to do whatever kindness, goodness, worthwhile thing we can in this planet while we're still here. Basically, to make good karma, to be kind, to be loving, to be forgiving, to be happy. And this is how we become happy, by letting the past go. And that's the other thing, the wonderful thing about letting go of the past. Person does die, if you have to cry at the funeral, leave your tears in the chapel.
We're here, sometimes we do funeral services here. Leave it in this hall. And go outside afterwards, into the sunshine. Because that's always what the dead people would want you. I'm not sure what you say to your loved ones, but I say to each one of you, and to the monks, when I die, please, if you're going to cry, cry during the funeral service. Afterwards, please don't cry. Otherwise, you are not keeping to my wishes. You know, just before I went to Malaysia, it's really, really weird. We got all these phone calls from Melbourne at our monastery just the day before I left. Because apparently there's a rumour going around Melbourne, because I've got lots of disciples over there. There's one centre that I'm spiritual advisor for. And they got a rumour that Ajahn Brahm had got cancer and was in hospital dying. So they rang me up and said, is it true that Ajahn Brahm's in hospital, got cancer and he's dying? So I said, first I've heard of it, and I'm Ajahn Brahm, I should know. But I said, the last part is true, I am dying, but maybe another 20, 30, 40 years, who knows. But yeah, I said, I agree to that, I'm dying. We're all dying, for goodness sake. But sometimes these rumours go about, and they're really crazy. What are you worried about? So when we understand just what Dharma truly is, we can let people go. When we let people go, we let the past go. We let the pain go. We let the grief go. We let the hurt go. Sometimes you wonder, why do we allow nature in life to cause us so much pain? Why do we cry when green leaves are taken off the tree? Can we think that something's gone wrong? We don't understand the truth of the matter. If we truly understand, we would not let the death of a young person, even a suicide, or the fact that our child wants to leave home, or the fact that sometimes the marriages, the partnerships, sometimes it does come a time when you just can't keep it together anymore. What a wonderful time we've had, what a wonderful life, but now it's finished. Please don't carry hate into your future. Never allow the past to cause you unhappiness in the present. You don't need to do that. When we let go of the pain of the past, it doesn't matter who did what to who. If someone did do something wrong or very hurtful and cruel to you, it's their karma. It's their stupidity. If you could understand why they did that, you maybe understand that, gee, people are put in some such difficult situations sometimes, and I don't know why people do that, but sometimes when I ask them, I can understand it more. I may not be able to accept it, but at least I can understand it, and understand the causes and conditions, the reason why they're acting in such terrible ways. But what I do understand, it doesn't make any sense, if they've hurt me once, to allow them to hurt me again. And every time I remember that painful time, I'm allowing them to hurt me one more time. Suicide is bad enough. A death of a loved one, a separation, someone you love going to some other part of the world. But why do we allow that pain to linger in our heart? To allow it to cause us suffering day after day every time we think of it? Which is why at a death, if it hurts us once, we should not allow it to hurt us tomorrow or the next day. We don't need to do that. You don't have to do that. You can let it go. Why not? Do the person who dies, do they want you to be sad for the rest of your week, month, year, life? No one wants that for their loved ones. So why can't we respect the person who's died? Out of respect for the person who's no longer here, I am going to be happy. Certainly my father, when he died when I was only 16, that's what he wanted me to do. He didn't want me to cry when he died, so I didn't. Out of respect, filial love for someone I admired. Can you see there's another way? A Buddhist way, a Dharma way, a truthful way, a way of real peace, of real love, and of freedom. That's what the Dharma is. This comes from the heart,
And hopefully you can taste and can touch. This is wisdom. This is liberation. This is freedom. This is real kindness, true compassion. Not just a theory, but which you apply to the cold face of life. What you face from time to time. Some of the tragedies which people have to deal with. And now you know how to deal with it. And its whole meaning is teaching you, training you, to really know what love really is, and to appreciate freedom, and also to know peace. They go in peace, and you go forward in peace. That's the meaning of life. So that's a little story today about letting go of the ones we love. So only one little joke in there, because it was a serious one today. So hopefully you don't mind. Now, some questions or comments about the talk tonight. Anyone got a question or comment about what's being said tonight? About letting go? There's a question up the back there. Can you? Okay, you're saying in a condition like of domestic violence. What does it really mean to let go? It means to let go as fast as you can by running away as fast as you can sometimes. Because, you know, that love of the other person, it's already a dysfunctional relationship when you get to that stage. You know, obviously there's a huge amount of frustration. Remember there is, say, almost like a sequence of like, wanting, controlling. Because eventually, when we try and control somebody, or control ourselves, or control life, control inevitably leads to frustration. Because we just can't control another person, we can't control ourselves, we can't control our body, we can't control life. So control freaks eventually get frustrated. And frustration leads to anger. For some people, anger leads to violence. But for all people, anger eventually leads to depression. Or just gives up. That's not the right way of life. You don't control another person. They want something out of their partner, but that's not the way to get it. It's counterproductive and the partner will leave. Usually the sooner the better. It's dangerous physically for the victim and also for the perpetrator. So, that's not letting go. Remember the door of my heart. A door is something which you enter, but it's also something you go out of. Always remember that. So sometimes you have to go out of the door of your house if it's intolerable. So common sense tells us the best way I can love that abusive partner is actually to get out quick. So seek professional help, because it's not working. Sitting there doing nothing. Unless you're an amazing person. I gave one story in my book about an amazing lady who could do that, but she's an exception. Most people seek professional help. Call the police. See the social worker. That's out of kindness for the person who's acting in such a crazy, harmful way. Harming themselves and harming others. Make sense? Okay. I know people sometimes misunderstand compassion. It's, oh, you can do anything you want to me. That's not compassion. That's foolishness.